It's time for another episode of the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast with your hosts, Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, Brad Tarver, and Jason Young.
Well, it's Christmas Eve, folks, at least at the point when we're recording this, probably when you guys are listening to it, it will definitely not be Christmas Eve, but it's Christmas Eve for us, so Merry Early Christmas.
Merry Christmas, fellas.
Come on, you're not going to get this thing edited and pushed out in one day? It's just Christmas Eve. What else you got to do?
Priorities. I got to watch Elf for the 45th time and Die Hard and whatever other Christmas movies I can come up with.
Yeah, I've been remiss. I haven't gotten my Die Hard fix in yet.
I bought it. I went on sale on iTunes and I bought it on Friday. I watched it and it's been a while since I've seen Die Hard. And that movie is just really good. I mean, it's just like good family Christmas movie. I mean, it really is.
Has it been remastered in 4K yet?
It has.
It has. It still looked, you know, I saw that it was in 4K. I'm like, oh, cool. And then it like kind of starts and I'm like, yeah, this is not 4K like some other 4Ks that I've seen. This is, you know, it's like a 0.4K, but, you know, it was still really good.
It's just stretched to the corners is all.
There's a really good extra if you buy it on iTunes, and it's been on the Blu-ray forever. But if you go into the extras, there's a part in there that goes, why widescreen? And I encourage anyone who at this point doesn't understand why widescreen is a good thing. Of course, everyone should by this point. I mean, it's all TVs are widescreen now. But back in the day when pan and scan was a big deal, there was this used to float around the internet. I think it used to be on the digitalbits.com. If you go and you watch this extra, it shows you the comparison when you're watching something that it shot for a 235:1 ratio. And it does how like the pan and scan versus the letterbox works. It's fascinating to watch. I was surprised because, you know, first of all, damn you, Jim, because between this and Heat, you kept reminding me of things that have been remastered in 4K that I don't own in 4K, which I hate going out and rebuying things. But the iTunes sale that's going on right now, that's really, really good. I've dropped a lot on iTunes in the last couple of days. You know, the whole Die Hard collection currently on iTunes is about $20. And I still only paid $8 for the first one because it's like, if I'm being honest with myself, I'll never watch any of the sequels. Like, I don't like any of the third one's okay, where you have Hans Gruber's brother. But other than that, I don't think I would really watch any of those, any of the sequels. So it's just like, you know what? I'm only going to buy the first one, even though it's a better deal to buy all of them. So, but yes, I went out and got that after you mentioned it. I also went out and rebought Heat, which I didn't own in iTunes. And this morning, just on a humbug, I was going over the, you know, Amazon and eBay both are doing some of those last minute Christmas deals where you get the, I mean, it's so common now to see the $85 get you a $100 iTunes card. And actually on Amazon, you can go higher than that and still get the $15 discount if you want to do it. But that seems like the way that I wanted to go. And I went out and I bought the 6-film Tarantino collection, which I realized I didn't own hardly anything. I think I only own Django and what was the other one? Hateful Eight are the only ones that I actually owned of Tarantino's in the iTunes store. So I went out and got Reservoir Dogs. And but what's weird is Inglourious Basterds is not in that collection, but From Dusk Till Dawn is, which is not really a Tarantino movie. He acts in it, but he didn't direct it. So that was kind of annoying.
Hateful Eight is one of those you watch it once and I never have to see it again movies.
Really?
Yeah, I felt the same way.
It was good. I liked it. It wasn't a bad movie, but I never have to see it again.
That's kind of how it was with Dusk Till Dawn, right? I mean, the movie, like the first hour of the movie was great, and it was very Tarantino-esque. And then when it made its plot twist to what it did, man, it kind of lost me there.
It's sort of like the dual movies that Rodriguez and Tarantino did with The Grindhouse, where you've got half of it is Tarantino and half of it is Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, definitely what it feels like. I can still watch From Dusk Till Dawn because there's just enough funny stuff in it. There's enough stuff that amuses me in it that it's okay. But yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying about The Hateful Eight. The cinematography in The Hateful Eight is just so good that I can watch that one over and over, but it's 3 hours long. You know, it's too much of an investment. That's what keeps me from going back and watching it.
It's 3 hours of death and hatefulness. I mean, it's just like, God.
Throttlegate, everybody. So Apple addresses the alleged throttling of iPhones with degraded batteries. You know, this is such a non-story. And, you know, as an aside, I know we mention him a lot, but our mutual Android friend, Jason, you know, I've been recovering from some surgery and he's like, you know, I haven't heard from you. He's like, all I can do not to just rag you over this whole Apple iPhone battery thing. And I wanted to reply back, well, you know, I guess they could go the Samsung route. And when the battery's done, it just explodes in your pocket. But
yeah, the hate in my Facebook feed, man, the Android fan fanboys have just been livid, like just losing their minds, just telling everybody, oh my God, we've told you for years that this is how it is. And, you know, I can't believe you would support a company that would do that to you. And I remember, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, I guess, when the Intel mobile chips came out, right? They were the first ones, you know, I'm talking about laptops. They were the first ones that would run at one speed on battery power and, you know, a considerably higher speed on AC power. And, you know, that was considered awesome, right? Like, you know, you weren't killing your battery and, you know, you may have had degraded performance, but, you know, the damn thing stayed on the whole time. And, you know, that's kind of the way that I look at this throttle gate, right? Is, you know, if you've got a diminished capacity battery that can't give you that full performance, instead of, you know, shutting off the device or telling you you can't run that app, right? Run it at a slower speed and give you a little bit longer battery life.
So for our users that, I mean, our users, so for our listeners that may not be intimately familiar with the entire throttle gate, maybe you've seen it in the news, as lithium ion batteries degrade, your iPhone is sort of faced with a choice during peak power consumption, which most people don't hit, I might add. And the phone can either shut down unexpectedly or reduce the need for peak power by spreading out the requests over several cycles. And most folks aren't walking around drawing peak power consumption. You're just not. So the phone will sometimes deprioritize whatever you're running. This is another important thing around the memory management of iOS in general, how, you know, things go into the background and they go into a suspended state. There's a lot of things going on here. And if we're also being honest, it was back in 2016 that Apple was noted to be using machine learning to extend your battery life by figuring out your usage patterns. So I think this is really kind of a non-story for more than people are letting on.
I disagree that it's a non-story. I don't have a problem with Apple doing what they're doing. I agree with it from that point of view. I understand technically what's going on here, that they're slowing down the phone to keep it from shutting down, and that most people would never hit that condition anyway. But I think the story here is that for a couple of years, people have said that their older phones get slower, and it was repeatedly denied that happens. And I'm not even saying that these two things are even related, because like we said, most people don't hit the peak power consumption to where your phone would even get slower. But the fact that the story here is that it took somebody running tests to figure out what was going on, and Apple finally admitted it. They got caught. Not giving the complete story.
It's not like they hid anything. It's not that it's... So you can see also, too, on the support pages for Apple, your iPhone battery is designed to retain 80% of its original capacity for 500 complete charge cycles. That's charging down to nothing and then back again. And when you get to the point where your battery needs to be replaced, and I've never seen this, but apparently according to the support docs, this is true, it will actually send you a notification telling you that you need to have your battery serviced because it is in a bad spot. So they do have sort of a transparency here. It's just that you're also seeing a condition that most people will not hit. So like if you're running Geekbench, you're going to be triggering that condition all the time. So yeah, when you're doing Geekbench and Reddit is exploding with, I told you, it's like you're in a situation where you're triggering this condition that most people don't see. So some of that...
No, I get that. I mean, you're peaking the CPU for the sake of peaking the CPU. I mean, I get that. I think the story here, more than Apple, that iOS does this, is that it took all of this on Reddit and, you know, all the testing for Apple to finally come out and say, yeah, we're doing this. I mean, I think it would have been a non-story if they would have come out at some point, you know, a year or two ago and said, look, you know, with these lithium ion batteries, this is what we have to do to keep your phone running. And, you know, this is how it is. I think they could have been more transparent with how it works.
If you'll remember, the previous stories were always sort of the conspiracy theory that we were throttling the older models to force you to upgrade, and it didn't really have anything to do with battery life or ongoing battery life. It was just that people were saying, oh, I have an iPhone 4. They're forcing me to upgrade by using new code to slow down my old phone. And
yeah, that, I mean,
so the stories are sort of, people are sort of mixing up the stories, I think.
I agree. It's a complete mixing up. I mean, it's one of those things where I think we all expected batteries to, that's an expected thing. Everybody knows your battery is going to get worse over time. But I don't think until now people knew that when your battery gets worse, that makes other part of your device not function as well. They would think that it would function the same, just not for as long. And Apple's kind of taken the approach of, you know, we would rather try to keep your phone operating at all instead of, you know, just the shorter time period there. I mean, it's all understandable. I just think they could have been more transparent with it.
The other thing that doesn't hurt or doesn't help Apple's case here is, you know, so many media outlets are trying to capitalize on this with so many clickbait, you know, headlines that almost, I mean, and I've seen some, you know, reputable places like, you know, I think of Ars Technica as kind of a place that doesn't typically do that, right? And they even had some sensational headlines. And the key behind this, right, is their consumer trust is going to go down because the consumer isn't going to actually read the article to find out what's actually happening, right? So in all their minds and in the, you know, court of public opinion, Apple is, you know, doing something deliberately malicious to make you upgrade yearly, and that causes loss of trust.
Find a good Apple podcast, people, and listen to it, and you'll find out what's really going on, and listen to it regularly and subscribe, and then you'll be in the know. That's what you need to do out there.
The other thing to remember, too, to Brad's point, is that usually when a new version of the OS comes out, if you upgrade it on older devices, they've gotten better about this, but in the past, newer versions of the OS didn't always run as smoothly on old versions of the hardware. So you're kind of in an unwinnable scenario, right? Do you not support older devices? Well, they're forcing me to upgrade because I can't put this OS on my old phone. Well, if you do, then this runs like crap. I have to go and upgrade. This is a conspiracy. So it's kind of strange. It is sort of an unwinnable situation. I wish they would.
Android's got that problem because they just don't put out new software to upgrade their devices.
That is true. Whatever you get when you buy the phone is typically what you're going to be running for a long time unless you have a good manufacturer. And even then. Yeah.
Well, to speak to the new OS on the old hardware argument, I mean, it's the same as it is on PCs with Windows operating systems. I mean, to have new features means more lines of code, which means you need a better processor to run those extra lines of code. It just makes sense. I mean, I don't know why people seem to think that it would be any different on a mobile device versus, you know, your desktop computer.
And I would argue, as much as most people rely on their phones, you're getting far more taxed on your mobile device than you are on a PC or anything else because you're always on it. It's always with you. You're always using it pretty hard. And we know that battery is the biggest problem in electronics today, right? That is the thing where the strides in technology aren't really matching like Moore's Law or anything. We're having, you know, we're getting better battery life, I guess, but not exponentially like you would expect with like CPU performance, for example.
It's still the limiting factor. Yeah. Like it's one thing that they truly have to still balance between size of the battery itself and the capacity of charging power. And, you know, we can make it really big, but then you've got a big phone in your pocket and it lasts forever. Whereas Apple's generally always taken their approach. And I think all of us have every now and then disagreed with this is, you know, we're still going to make these things as small as we can, no matter what. And, you know, we're going to give you about a day if we can, and there you go. But, you know, we're going to keep making the phone smaller because I don't know. That's sexy. I don't know what the.
Well, it's a true measure of diminishing returns. I've got a neighbor across the street who has built his own drone, and he's 3D printed a lot of the structural parts of it. And he was kind of hitting that crossroads where he can have more battery, but it weighs more, etc. And it just comes down to the same thing with the phones as far as size versus power.
Well, speaking of batteries, right, I managed to do something earlier this week that I have not been able to do previously, and that was I actually ran my iPhone X out of battery. Like, I was shocked. It was the first day since I've gotten it, and, I mean, I was on the phone a ton that day. I was also sick and didn't feel well, so, you know, that was my primary computer that day, so read a ton of articles, played some Audible books, played some iTunes stuff. And, you know, at 9 o'clock, it actually powered off. And I was like, oh my God, that's the first time I've actually run this thing out of power.
You didn't go into battery saving mode, you said, or you did?
I didn't. I mean, I just, you know, I got the notice that it was like 20%, 10%, and just kind of shrugged it off. And I was just still surprised that I was able to run it down because it has been very impressive since I bought it.
I don't think I've killed mine yet. Now that I'm thinking, I mean, I'm always near a battery or a charger or something. I guess I haven't been out and about long enough where I've killed it. I've come really close a couple of times where, you know, I've been like at 5 or 10% coming home late at night, but I don't think I've actually had it shut down on me.
So it's just a good point to remind folks that if you're under AppleCare Plus, you get a free battery replacement during your 2-year coverage, which I always typically remind myself around when I used to keep phones for this long. Even if I would gift them to other family members before I would do it, I would take it to the Apple Store and invoke that free battery replacement. So go ahead and do that if you have AppleCare Plus. Try to do it toward the end of your coverage so that you maximize that battery life, and this will be a non-issue for you. If you're not under AppleCare, it costs $79, I think, plus $5 shipping to get your battery replaced, which on a, you know, $600, $700, $800, $900 phone, that's not really a bad deal, especially if you do it, you know, once every couple of years, just like the routine maintenance you would have to do on a car or anything else. This is something you use all the time. If you want to keep your battery at peak performance every couple of years, just have the battery replaced.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you're, you know, going out and buying a couple of AAAs for this thing, right?
Ain't that the truth? So moving on to happier news, or more expensive baller news, the iMac Pro is finally out as of December 14th. What do you guys think of the iMac Pro?
That thing is gorgeous.
Space gray is sexy.
It truly, truly is. This thing is beautiful.
I think my first comment to y'all was, I want that keyboard and that mouse and all that stuff. And Brian immediately replied, he was like, you gotta buy the whole thing.
It's like the contest where you would pay, I don't know, $50,000 for something and get a free t-shirt. It's sort of like, yeah, you can get the gray mouse and keyboard, but you've got to buy the $5,000 computer to get it.
You know, at first when I saw the $5,000 price tag, right, you know, you kind of get a little bit of sticker shock there. But, you know, as I'm sitting behind a 2009 Mac Pro right now, I started doing the math, right? Back in 09 when I bought it, and it, you know, this is the 8-core Xeon model. I want to say that I gave like $3,000 for the tower and like $1,000 for the 24-inch Apple Cinema display. So to get a machine, I guess, 8-9 years later for only $1,000 more, that's considerably a higher, better quality machine. I guess it's not really overpriced.
I mean, the base stats here, I guess I'd seen it, but I hadn't, you know, like looking at it here in our show notes that Brian is so gracefully prepared for us. You know, 5K gets you, you know, 8 cores, 32 gigs of RAM, a big honking GPU, and a terabyte SSD. I mean, that's, and you get that big, beautiful screen to go with it all too, and all that sexy space gray peripherals. So, I mean, I would love to have one. It's not something that I would use since I don't work from home that much anymore. But, you know, I definitely think that Apple is come out with something here where, you know, it's like, okay, please, 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 please shut up, you professional people. You know, here we're throwing you a bone. You know, this is a loaded, beautiful machine at a reasonable price for what you're getting. And then you could spec it out, you know, even more so, like, you know, almost triple that price for ungodly amounts of RAM and hard drive space. Thank you, Apple. I'm not going to buy one, but, you know, it's nice that this is available now. You know, maybe it'll pretend to some better things coming.
So 2 years ago this month for my 40th birthday, I treated myself to a maxed out 5K iMac. And looking at my stats right now as we're recording this, I paid about $4,500 and I got a 4-core i7. And I did add the memory myself, so I had 32 gigs of RAM, and my video card is a Radeon with 4 gigs of memory. So for $5K now, what will $5,000 buy you? Well, it would buy you an 8-core Xeon processor, the same 32 gigs of RAM, and an 8-gig Radeon Pro GPU, and a 1-terabyte SSD, which I think I have a 1-terabyte SSD in this as well. So if you look at it, the base model you get for $5K is only about $500 more than I paid for a fully maxed out 5K iMac 2 years ago. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not like they jacked up the price a lot higher than what it would have been for an iMac. I could see myself in maybe 2 or 3 years going out and buying the base model of the Space Gray iMac Pro to replace my current 5K iMac when it ages out. Probably more than 2 years, because I typically all my Mac hardware 6 years before upgrading it. But it's not, in the grand scheme of things, for what you're getting, it's actually not that reason, not that badly priced. If I'd had this option 2 years ago where I could get a fully maxed out iMac, or I could pay $500 more and get like an 8-core Xeon with 32 gigs of RAM and an 8-gig Radeon Pro, I would have picked the iMac Pro in a heartbeat because it would have been a better deal.
Same here.
So also listen to the comment that you just made, right? You said that you upgrade your Mac hardware like every 6 years. Think about PC users, right? How many PC users keep their stuff for 6 years? I mean, that's why I'm sitting here talking to you guys today on a 2009 Mac Pro, right? Is, you know, over the years, I've thrown more RAM in it. I converted it to SSD, put in a better video card. And like, I can't really justify, I can't really outrun this thing as it sits. So I don't have a need to upgrade.
Jason, come on. Eight years? Come on, man. Your dink status is in question here. You're using a machine 8 years old.
Can't run High Sierra on it, can you? Unless you do some breaking the EULA type of stuff to make that happen, though, right?
I am sitting here running the High Sierra right now, sir. But it
wasn't sanctioned from the mothership, was it?
Well, so the thing is, the BIOS firmware for the 2010 model, actually, the motherboards in the 09s and the 10s are both the same, right? They just switched to a newer version of the Intel Xeon processor. So I went in and flashed the 2010 BIOS onto this motherboard, and the 2010 Mac Pros are supported by High Sierra. So I also get Siri as well.
So you're good for another year.
Yeah, probably.
Well, I mean, to your point about the upgrading PCs, most of the folks that we know, I mean, if you break them into two camps, you have like the power users, they will typically do what we do, where they'll go out and upgrade the motherboard and the video card and all the other stuff. But your average PC users, they'll buy some crappy mid-level PC and they'll probably keep it 2 or 3 years before upgrading. With your Macs, they typically have a much longer shelf life, mostly because Mac OS gets upgraded for years and years and years. My 2009 iMac that I gave to my parents, it actually runs High Sierra. Like, I think it'll be the last year it gets upgraded. But I mean, think about that. That's 8 years of updates that it's continued to receive, which you don't really see that in the PC world. And even if you do, it's usually, to take it back to the throttle gate comparison, it's usually not usable on hardware that's old. But with the iMacs and the Macs in general, you don't typically have that problem. Newer versions of Mac OS don't usually run like garbage on older hardware, has been my experience. So it does have a longer life for what you're paying for. So, you know, that's at least something to consider. But I know that when this one does age out, and it almost makes me want to age this one out prematurely, but I won't do that. Even I won't do that. That iMac Pro, that space gray is just, I even heard it had a black space gray lightning cable or something that came with it, which just made me laugh of like, wow, they really took it to the extreme.
I have the iMac model previously that came out one model before Brian's did, and I paid about $3,800 for mine and then added 32 gigs of RAM to it for $400 or so. So if you consider AppleCare and all the other crap, you know, I mean, it comes out to be about $5,000 because I got the 1 terabyte SSD in it. It's just, but it's the same. I think his processor is a little bit newer, but it's still a 4-core i7. I bought the Bretford VESA, two-headed VESA mount for mine. So I bought mine without the built-in stand. So, I mean, it really did. I mean, I think after tax and everything, mine came out to be about $4,600. That's before I bought the extra RAM.
I mean, I think with the AppleCare, this MacBook Pro that I'm sitting here against, I think it butted right up on $4,000 with, you know, when you added in like the $300 for the AppleCare and taxes and everything else. I'm pretty sure it was close to $4,000 for my replacement model from whatever it was, May or June.
I think if faced with a MacBook Pro or the iMac Pro, I would spend the five G's on the iMac Pro over the MacBook. I would sooner take a lower end MacBook and just remote into my iMac Pro from anywhere before I, especially seeing the experience you've had with the MacBook Pro, Jim. I would sooner go with the iMac Pro no matter what.
I concur. I definitely concur. I need special luggage where I could just take my iMac Pro and put it in my luggage and bring it with me to work every week, you know?
You just need a dumb terminal, basically, when you travel. Like, you know, we were talking the other day and you had your eye on like a Surface or something like that. You had your eye on some sort of Windows laptop and it's like, you know what? Would that really be the worst thing if you're just remoting back into your Mac and just doing this for your normal work? I don't think so.
I saw a sail on the surface, and I mean, I'll admit I'm a little intrigued. You know, they look sharp. You know, the keyboard and little snappy like iPad type keyboard, and so it was like $800 was the ad, and I'm like, oh cool, you know, let's go look at it. And I realized it, you know, it's like buying a Lexus, where yeah, you can get a Lexus for $30,000, but the Lexus you really want costs $50,000. It's the same thing with this Surface. You could get one for $799, but to get one that you would really want to use, you're gonna pay over $2,000 for it. I mean, it's the same exact machine. And it goes all the way from 800 up to over $2,000, which is really just crazy. I mean, I guess the MacBook Pros are similar, but they start a lot higher and go up. I mean, this to go from 800 with like a, you know, a crappy non-i series processor all the way up to an i7 in the same machine, it was kind of, I was surprised, you know, when I went and looked at it. So
here's what you do, Jim. So what you do is you go and you sell your MacBook Pro on Craigslist or whatever it is you do. Go out and get yourself an iMac Pro. But here's the kicker. Go get yourself a cheap laptop and then move all of your processing power into a virtual desktop on AWS. So then everything you need to do, you're just doing it completely remotely. You're paying a nominal fee.
I just get a Chromebook, man. Just get a Chromebook and do it all. And
see, that's all you need. I mean, really. I mean, you don't really need anything that's powerful when you're traveling. And this gives you incentive to remote back into yourself and do all that good stuff. So see, you would have the best experience. I've never regretted my iMac purchase, ever.
See, Jim, you could even be super cool like the guy at the Starbucks a couple exits south of me. I see him in there two or three times a year. Dude literally rolls in and pulls out a 24-inch iMac and sits it on the table and plugs it in and just uses it as his remote office all day.
I've seen that at Starbucks before. I have seen that where somebody has an iMac in Starbucks, like the whole big shebang.
Is that what the kids call extra? Is that what I'm hearing, what the kids are calling it?
I think that's lit.
I think I would, to justify sitting there that long, I think I would actually have to attach an IV of coffee just to I'm just going to make this my office now.
Bring in some little foam partitions and put it up around the table space. Just close yourself in.
It is pretty obnoxious when you think about it. Yeah, if you're going to bring something like that in, that's taking Rude to a whole new level. Anywho, moving along, keeping this thing going. So Amazon says, and it turns out that Apple confirms, that Prime Video had the most first week downloads of any Apple TV app ever. And what do you guys think about Prime Video being on Apple TV now?
Well, to those stats, I mean, everybody's been waiting for that. I mean, you hear people like us who have had, you know, two devices. They may have the Chromecast and an Apple TV, or a Fire Stick and an Apple TV, or Roku or whatever. And they say, man, I would totally get rid of that second device and just use Apple TV, if just Prime Video would come to the Apple TV. And I mean, that's what everybody's been waiting for. And I tell you, I've watched more Prime Video now in the past couple of weeks than I ever have before, just solely because I don't have to switch back and it's right there on the screen for the Apple TV. So it's sort of a reminder to like, oh yeah, let's go watch something on there.
The integration with the Up Next and the TV application that's in the Apple TV is really nice, right? So yeah, I've been watching a couple of shows that are only available on Amazon, sprinkled in. Like, I bought the iTunes had every season of The Office on sale for $5 a season, right? So I bought that. So I've been watching that and watching some Amazon shows. And so it's kind of nice to go to that TV app and see iTunes content and Amazon Prime content in the same spot. And, you know, not really having to choose the app, it just kind of loads it for me. One of the things that you've also got in the show notes is talking about, you know, the updated version of the Prime Video app now supports 5.1 audio. I don't know what's going on my machine or what. I may end up having to uninstall and reinstall, but 5.1 still is not working with the upgraded version of Prime Video on my Apple TV 4K.
I installed it, and the only thing I've watched so far is three or four episodes of Grand Tour. Isn't that what it's called, Grand Tour? Am I saying that right? Yeah, basically Top Gear Amazon style.
Top Gear 2.0.
That's the only thing I've watched, and I've really enjoyed that show. I think the interface is good. One thing that I guess I didn't realize is there. I know I mentioned it to people at work that it was available. There's a lot of people that they don't pay for streaming services just because they don't pay for streaming services, but everybody pays for Prime. I mean, just like Prime is is like having power at your house. I mean, people just have Prime. And so I think that's the, you know, the reason it was, you know, one of the most downloaded apps ever is you've got people who normally wouldn't, you know, they don't pay for HBO Now, or they don't pay for Netflix, or they don't pay for Hulu. You know, they don't have a streaming service like that, but they pay for Prime, not because of Prime Video, but because of the other benefits. And now they're actually taking advantage of the streaming Prime service. I think that it could end up helping out some of the other streaming services. I mean, because it's bringing that streaming functionality that some people maybe haven't made that final leap into that. They realize how easy it is. So I think, you know, it's actually may end up helping the Netflixes and Hulus, because, you know, the last batch of folks who might not have been streamers, who are kind of, I'm not saying they're getting this for free, but it's, you know, it's a benefit that they maybe haven't taken advantage of before now, and they realize how easy it is. It's going to kind of hit on the cable companies even more if you know, if it all hadn't already.
A rising tide lifts all ships, I believe, is the phrase that you're looking for.
Yeah, there you go. I was out late. That's a good one.
I've had a Roku and an Amazon Fire whatever dongle on a lot of my TVs, but I never, in retrospect, I hate that I did that, because I never hardly use them. But just because I believe this is what I believe John Siracusa on other podcasts had referred to as the battle for like HDMI 1, I believe it was called, where, you know, when you have a device that's hooked in that you rely on, you typically tend to go for that one more than switching inputs, more than anything else. And it's really kind of true to be able to do that. So I've actually watched a lot more Prime now that I've got it on the Apple TV than I had previously. And being able to use the Siri search feature too, to be able to look for something and say, show me movies with whoever in it, or a TV show with this, and seeing the open in Prime Video is a lot more helpful than having to pop over to another input, pick up another remote, talk into it, or do whatever you want to do to search it. I mean, it's been good, even though the UI is uniformly terrible. It is the same UI that they seem to use on every single device. And I saw someone on Twitter mention the fact that it supports third generation Apple TV probably tells you how long Amazon was sitting on this app and had one ready to go and just wouldn't release it, which is the most, because nothing supports, you know, the Series 3 brand new that comes out today. It's usually fourth generation and 4K are the ones that it supports. So that's kind of annoying that it was like this. But to your point, Jim, I think Amazon needed to be on the Apple TV just as much as the Apple TV needed Amazon, even though I think Amazon probably wouldn't say that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many more people watching Prime Video now than there ever were. I mean, whether you like it or not, there's a lot of Apple TVs out there. And maybe it's just the people I know. I mean, you know, I think it's pretty obvious when they say it's the most downloaded app first week ever is pretty crazy.
I thought it was typical Amazon bluster and Apple wouldn't confirm it. But according to the link that I'll put in the show notes, the actual report came from Apple itself. And it was just a coincidence that it was a similar PR firm that Amazon has worked with before. So it looked like Amazon was boasting. And it was kind of like, well, how can Amazon make that claim if they don't have access to Apple's statistics for other apps, which of course they wouldn't, but apparently this is something Apple is boasting. So I think it's a mutually beneficial relationship for both of them as well.
So I mentioned Grand Tour, and that's the low-hanging fruit, because that's the one, you know, I think that got a lot of press when Amazon made it. So each of y'all give the one show that you think people should be watching on Amazon Prime, because I honestly need to know this too, because like I said, all I've really done is the Grand Tour so far. So what else should people be watching that's Prime only?
I like the cop show Bosch. That's pretty good. There, I think there's two seasons of it that's already out. And then I also like the show Sneaky Pete. That was pretty good.
Let me ditto that. Sneaky Pete is a good show. You should really check it out. It's one that will pull you in. It's about a con man who gets released from prison, and I won't say much more than that, but you really should watch that. I'm going to throw out a couple of them. Jean-Claude Van Johnson is another one you should watch. The reason you should watch it, it's not a great show, but it's six episodes long, and it just came out December 15th, and it's Jean-Claude Van Damme sort of doing a self-parody like he did in the movie JCVD, sort of similar to that. He plays a secret agent who, you know, he's really Jean-Claude Van Damme, but he goes and shoots terrible movies. And while he's making terrible movies, he works for a top secret spy agency that's run by Felicia Rashad from The Cosby Show. So
oh God.
It's, it is, It is silly and goofy. Like in the first 30 seconds, you find out that in his house, he only showers in coconut water, which is a recurring theme that comes back over and over and over and in very hilarious ways. He goes on the run at one point and has to hide where someone wouldn't look for him. And I'm not going to ruin the gag, but when you see it and they just keep finding new ways to exploit that gag, it's pretty funny. But again, it's only 6 episodes long. Each one's half an hour. So you can blow through it in like a couple of hours. And it's pretty good. The Tick is also pretty good as well.
That sounds fun. Oh yeah, The Tick. I saw that one on the screen, and I really like that fella. What's his name?
Peter Serafinowicz. Not Patrick Warburton. We're not talking about the 2001 Tick that was on Fox. We're talking about the new Tick that's exclusive to Amazon Prime, which has Peter. I think it's Peter Serafinowicz is the way you. The guy who did the voice of Darth Maul. He's been in a lot of things. He was in Guardians of the Galaxy. It's been updated for modern audiences, and it's pretty good as well. There's actually some decent TV shows that they have on there that you really need to check out.
I'm a big fan of horror. I just love horror movies, and there's a new show on there called Lore, and it's they kind of take, you may have heard about sort of an urban legend or whatever from when you were a kid or whatever, and they bring in facts about it that sort of bring to light about what was really happening when you hear about, I don't know, the Salem witch trials or where the idea of vampires came from and stuff. It's pretty neat.
Okay, so it's not a scripted show. It's an actual, like...
It's sort of a documentary-type show. Yeah, okay, cool. But they do have some dramatizations of situations, I guess, to just sort of explain what's going on. So the liquid metal Terminator guy, he's in it. What's his name?
Robert Patrick.
Robert Patrick, thank you. He's in one episode where he plays the patriarch of a family where there's some situation going on. So, I mean, there's a couple of, I guess, C-list celebrities in the show that are playing these dramatizations. But there is, you know, some documentary-type explanation of old, you know, lore, and, you know, exactly what the show is called. I mean, I like it. It's been a good show. I've already been through all the episodes.
It reminds me of Drunk History for some reason. I just, that was always one of my favorites. And
also a great show.
You know, it's like they take C-list celebrities and get people drunk. And yeah, it's not an Amazon show, but it's really funny if you've never watched Drunk History.
It's a Comedy Central show, but you can find it on Hulu.
And you can learn something.
Let's see what else is going on out there. So if you want to halt and restart your service on your LTE Apple Watch, it's going to cost you. And that's how they get you. So, of course, it would be this way. So the same stupid activation fees that they have with your phone also apply to your watch. So now that you have it activated and you get your 3 free months, it's actually probably cheaper to keep it on than to turn it on and off as you need it. So that's disappointing that, you know, this thing that's right up there with ATM fees in terms of something that shouldn't exist in this day and age but somehow does and everybody's okay with is still a thing.
Speaking of ATM fees, man, I hit like an $8 one last night. It was bad.
I won't even have to ask where you did that.
Well, so one of the things that just kind of ticks me off about this, right, is when the first cellular-enabled iPads came out, you didn't have these activation fees, right? You know, you could spin up and spin down service pretty regular. I had one of the first ones. We would only turn it on for maybe like 2 or 3 months out of the year. And it was always like, you know, whenever we'd go to Florida for vacation or something, right? I'd turn it on for that, you know, a lot of times around Christmas time because we'd be out traveling more, you know. So we know that all of the major carriers are able to spin these things up and down without invoking activation fees or even having to talk to a human being. So why do you have to do it for, you know, LTE Apple Watches beyond me?
Same reason for the phone. I mean, it's $30 when you get a brand new iPhone, right? Why can't I just take the SIM from my old phone and pop it in my new one and why do I have to pay anything to activate a device? I'm paying for the privilege of putting a device on their network, something that benefits them and that I'm going to be...
They should be like coming to you for that.
There should be a negative fee associated with this because I'm bringing you a recurring fee every month. So now
of their loyalty to them.
Yes, exactly.
It always chaps my buns when you have to do that for like the iPad. You know, when you want to activate your cellular iPad and, you know, you're already adding 10, whatever it is, bucks a month or something. And, oh, yeah, we're going to charge you 35 or some stupid, crazy fee for just basically turning on your SIM card. I mean, that
they're not sending a technician out to climb a pole and flip a switch, right? This is all software. It's all happens automatically. There's zero charge. This is just pure profit in their pockets.
It's cheaper to have DirecTV send somebody out to your house and install a satellite on the roof than it is for them to flip a switch and turn on a SIM card. I mean, DirecTV is like, please let us come out and install a dish on your roof.
And with the Apple Watch, it's an eSIM, so it's not like they're even having to recover the 10 cents to make the SIM or 2 cents or whatever it takes to put the SIM together. They didn't even pay for the cost of that. So if there was a politician that just ran on getting rid of activation fees and ATM fees, I think I would probably vote for that politician.
Yeah, now that we're done with net neutrality, that's our next front page on our Reddit story is let's get rid of activation fees.
Fees and added taxes.
So let's see, since it's been kind of slow being December and whatnot, have you guys all seen The Last Jedi yet? And if you did, what did you think? No spoilers.
I'll be the odd man out and say I have not seen it.
It was too long and really slow in parts. The really good parts were really good. It was definitely not my favorite. I preferred the first one that came out here recently more than this one. And also the one that was just like a Star Wars story, whatever that one was called.
Rogue One.
Yeah. I enjoyed Rogue One a lot more than this one. There's a couple of characters in it that just annoy me. And it was, like I said, it was long and slow. I'm glad I saw it. I mean, obviously I've got to see it, you know. Eh. I'm kind of meh. I was for the build. The hype was definitely more than the fight.
Well, they're going to hype it. I mean, it's probably one of the most beloved, you know, nerddoms there is, as far as, you know, going back to our age, people's childhoods and whatnot. I mean, that's one of the things I loved the most as an 8-year-old was Star Wars. I actually liked this one better than Force Awakens, just because I thought Force Awakens was just a rehash of, you know, Return of the Jedi and the original Star Wars, where they
I was going to say, you mean A New Hope. It wasn't like Return of the Jedi.
Well, I mean, just where they just try to blow up, you know, the Death Star. They just named the Death Star a different thing on A Force Awakens.
But those were good movies, though. They remade a good movie.
So I think you needed a palate cleanser, as Wayne Campbell would have said, a sorbet to clear the palate between the prequels and the new stuff. So I didn't really mind that The Force Awakens sort of, you know, went beat for beat with A New Hope. And without being spoilery, I didn't realize that they gave director Rian Johnson the ability to completely do what he wanted to do in this movie. So it was kind of like, you know, you see The Force Awakens, you're like, okay, I know how the rest of these are going to kind of go. The template has been laid out. And he had the ability to go, nope, I can do whatever I want. And he's actually been put in charge of the next trilogy, which will be...
And then he slapped a millennial feeling sticker on it and gave us this new movie.
He'll be able to do whatever he wants to do for this next trilogy that will be non-Skywalker related that happens after episode 9. So I don't know how I feel about all of that. I don't know. I'm starting to think maybe these movies just aren't for me. I don't know.
This movie was like a Floyd Mayweather fight. It was all hype up to the fight, and then it was just like, you know, they danced around the ring for a couple hours, and it was over.
It should have been edited, and much like a Mayweather fight, it goes on too long, too. So I really wish it had been edited down a good bit. It could have lost half an hour off the running time easily and been just fine.
I agree.
I am excited about the next sort of a Star Wars story installment, you know, whatever the next Rogue One is going to be, or the next...
That'll be the Han Solo movie, right? But that had to be reshot completely after, just like Rogue One, had to be reshot completely after they got rid of the directors and had to bring Ron Opie Howard in to finish it.
Yeah, the Star Wars story one was Rogue One, but that was I guess that was just good fun, and that's what I expect from a Star Wars movie, and that's just not what I would describe for Last Jedi. It just wasn't good fun for me.
Outside of the couple of goofy moments, and I'm not going to spoil them there, you know, I guess I already did, but there are a couple of goofy moments in Last Jedi where I think they're meant to, you know, obviously make the whole theater laugh, but they're sort of just stupid. You know, they could have left it out, you know.
I would agree. Speaking of movies, before we go,
Jason, real quick here. The next time we talk, there will be spoilers, so you need to go see the damn movie.
Fair enough.
Plus, to be on this podcast, you have to at least see Star Wars. You don't have to genuflect and hold it in the same reverence, but you at least have to see it.
Agreed.
Duly noted, gentlemen.
So, speaking of movies, before we go, did you guys see the Netflix original that's been lighting up the internet with both good and bad reviews called Bright with Will Smith? Have you guys watched that yet?
I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet. The soundtrack's got a couple of cool songs on it, though. I've listened to some of that on Spotify and Apple Music.
I found it to be not bad. I saw a lot of the reviews were all over the place. Some people thought it was terrible. Some people thought it was great. I'm firmly in the I had low expectations going in, and it kind of exceeded those. It's sort of like the movie Alien Nation from the late 80s. I don't know how many of our listeners remember that, where you had like a space alien cop and just an average Joe type of cop. It's a lot like that, but it's like meets Lord of the Rings. So I enjoyed it a lot. But I also like the spectacle of what Netflix is trying to do with having sort of theatrical. I mean, when you watch it, it is clearly a theatrical budgeted type of film. I think it costs like $90 million to make, which for a Netflix movie is insane. They've already greenlit a sequel, and it is one of the few titles that supports Atmos on Netflix, which is also nice.
Did this come out of nowhere? I mean, I just feel like, you know, there was no hype. There was no, I didn't hear anything about it. And then all of a sudden it was just like, it just dropped. It was just like, hey, we got this big budget movie. Everybody come watch it.
It's been announced for a while. They've been talking about it.
I had seen a couple of trailers for it at the movie theater, you know, before a couple of movies, even before Last Jedi, even though I saw Last Jedi at like this podunk place in South Mississippi, I had seen it before at another theater. I'm talking about the trailer, not Last Jedi, but I had seen it at the beginning of another movie somewhere else.
I'm going to go off on a tangent for just a second, though. I found an article this week that I want to link to, and they were saying that Netflix was using its own medium as the advertising platform to see how things went. So based off of your previous recommendations, it would let you know the movie existed, but more than that, based off the things that you actually liked on Netflix or watched on Netflix, it would tailor the advertisements of what you saw to you. So if you were a fan of cop movies, it would play up the cop angle. If you were a fan of fantasy, it would play up the fantasy angle. Like, they had several different campaigns, and then based off your viewing preferences, what it showed you to entice you to watch it was completely different, which I also found fascinating. And one last thing about that is we've had the announcement that Disney's buying 21st Century Fox, and there are several, you know, folks that are all scared, like, oh, this is a big antitrust thing, and now Disney's going to control like 25% of all the output in Hollywood. But honestly, looking at stuff like what Netflix is doing, I don't think it's going to matter in the long term. I think what Netflix is doing is the future, and traditional Hollywood needs to be scared, because when you can take things like they're doing with that, the analytics they're doing on folks, and even tailoring the advertising to your particular viewing habits, that platform is not only the viewing platform, but now the advertising platform as well. That's pretty cool. Not to mention the fact that when you watch a movie, right, the opening day weekend is usually what determines if it's a hit or not, right? If it comes out, and it bombs, like, oh, it had a bad first week. That's a lot of pressure to put on a studio. So the article I read was speculating, how does Netflix figure this out? And it's like, for Netflix, they can play the long game. They don't care if you watch it opening day or you watch it 3 years from now when you just stumble across it, as, you know, they can open this thing on this.
As long as you've paid for Netflix every month of those 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but they can also open it worldwide on the same day. It's fascinating how Netflix is changing the industry, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because a lot of the traditional paradigms that we're used to no longer apply, and I don't think that anyone else has quite figured out what Netflix has. So that's something that I found interesting.
Netflix's new slogan's going to be, all your content are belong to me.
It pretty much is.
Well, I mean, Netflix has been there since the beginning. I mean, they were sort of the first streaming platform when it came to that whole paradigm, and then they can also, I mean, just for one example of them knowing what's popular and what's not is, you watch one episode, everybody watches the first episode of whatever this new show may be, and then they know who's watching it based on, like, oh, I got to watch the next 8 or 10 episodes in a 24-hour sitting. I mean, they know whoever's binging. I mean, that's how they gather those stats.
I was a little worried about Netflix a while back, a year or three ago, as
When they started losing the content, yeah.
They started losing more movies, And then now, if you log in, the sheer amount of original content that they've got going now is crazy. It's like every time I log in, there's some sort of new show. I mean, I usually stay on top of things, and I am definitely falling behind with everything. I just finished The Crown this week, the season two of The Crown. And I mean, just a show like that, I watched it over a matter of, you know, probably three sittings, you know, 10 hours of TV. It's just so compelling and so good. So it's crazy. And then every time I mention one show to somebody, they throw back two more that I may or may not have heard of, but I've never watched. And I'm like, okay, I got to add those to my list. I mean, it never stopped.
Something we neglected to mention too is that I think Prime actually has the largest collection of movies on streaming right now, even more than Netflix does. So that's something to consider. But seeing where Netflix is putting all their effort into the original content, I agree. Used to, the way I would keep track of what's on Netflix that was new is to go to the Wikipedia entry and look for Netflix original shows, just as sort of a way to keep on top of it. But I agree with you. Every time I log in, it's something completely new. But I will say I'm loving the Atmos and the Vision stuff on Netflix. Like when you watch that on a TV and sound system that's capable of it, it looks really, really amazing. The whole time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, this is going to kill the theaters right here. When they can make movies that I can watch and sound this good and look this good without me having to go anywhere or do anything, why am I going to go and, as we talked about in our last episode, put up with all the people smacking on awful food and rattling paper when I can sit at home and watch it in 4K with, you know, surround sound that's just awesome. And it's going to be a constant torrent, no pun intended, of new content coming down the pipe. One last thing before we go as well, Nintendo Switch. Jim, I wanted to ask, have you picked up a Pro Controller yet for your Switch?
I have not, and I saw you put that in the show notes, and I was definitely, if we didn't get to it, I was going to ask you about it, because they're like $60, right? And every time I look at one, I keep waiting for one to go on sale for $40 or whatever, and maybe I'd pick one up.
It's not gonna happen. They're mostly 70 is what they mostly are. And when I post the link, they're 60. So when they drop to 60, it's a good time to get one. My wife and I were playing Mario Kart at like midnight last night. I have two of those controllers. They're great. If you're playing Super Mario.
Baller.
I know, right? When you're playing Super Mario Odyssey, there's a thing where you have to fling the hat, and of course, being Nintendo,
yeah,
you have to shake the controller in a weird fashion. So being able to do that, you get the vibration feedback. It's basically the controller that should be with this thing. But I'm loving that. I gotta emphasize again, loving the Switch.
All right, well, cool. Yeah, I'll have to check out that controller, because I mean, the other ones, they do feel kind of chintzy when you're using them. But I get it, because they've got to be portable/not. And
next time I travel, that thing's definitely going on the plane with me.
Yeah, it is fun on the plane. The only problem, again, is no Bluetooth sound. So make sure and bring some corded headphones.
Yep. Well, I think that should do it for this week, unless you guys have anything you want to mention before we go.
How about a happy holidays to everybody out there? You'll be listening to this later, so maybe it's a happy new year. You know, we really enjoy all our listeners, and we enjoy any feedback that you could give to us. You know, I just want to say thanks to y'all three. You know, this podcast has been a lot of fun this year, and we'll definitely carry it on into next year. It's great getting together with you three and talking about all this tech nerdery every week. So,
indeed.
Agreed, man. I really appreciate y'all adding me to the show this year, and looking forward to, you know, some great things that we can do in 2018.
Same here. More growth, onward and upward, and grateful for all of our listeners. We really are. So thank you for listening, and we will keep it going into 2018.
And 2020. And 2025. And 2040.
Yeah, by that time, we'll just have, like, the mic and everything will just be built into our eyes and ears, and Brian won't have to worry about any, you know, anything where I'm lagging or not plugged in or anything. It'll just be basically, he'll just come and pop into my head at 8:30 a.m. and say, "Get up, Jim, it's time to podcast." And I'm like, "Damn it, Brian, get out of my head."
Exactly. I can't wait for those days either. I can't wait for when I don't need an iMac to do my optimal editing, even though I have edited many episodes on the iPad using Ferrite, but I digress. That should do it for this week, fellas. Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, and we will see you next time. Later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Later, later fellas.
Please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter. We're at infinloopback. That's at I-N-F-I-N loopback. I'm Brian B. That's at B-R-I-A-N-B. Jim is at Big Jim, that's at B-I-G-J-I-M. Jason is at J-S-N-Y-N-G, that's at J-S-N-Y-N-G. And Brad is at Meester Idle, that's at M-E-E-S-T-E-R-I-D-L-E. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.